Welcome to Payment Matters. I'm your host, Jeff Lynn. Thanks for tuning in. On this show, we talk about the ever-changing landscape of healthcare payments and the impacts to healthcare payers, providers, and consumers. You can follow the conversation on Twitter at #PaymentMatters and follow me at Jeff B. Lynn. We have a gracious guest today. For today's episode is Dr. Chris DiRienzo, who is the Chief Medical Officer of Cardinal Analytics Solutions. Chris, really thanks for joining me today. Maybe for the listeners out here, you mind telling us a little bit about your background and experience in healthcare?
Happy to do so, Jeff. And thank you guys again for having me on the show. I'm Chris DiRienzo. You can follow me on Twitter at Chris DiRienzo MD. And you can follow Cardinal Analytics on Twitter at Cardinal Analytics. I'm a neonatologist by background, trained at Duke. And I work today at a company called Cardinal Analytics Solutions, where I serve as Chief Medical Officer.
Before Cardinal Analytics, sounds like you're a practicing physician out there. How long were you doing that?
Yeah, so I finished my fellowship and I joined a health system based in Asheville, North Carolina, called Mission Health. I got to work there for 5 years, serving in executive leadership and practicing as a neonatologist. I got to see kids in our NICU follow-up clinic, but the last role I had there for several years was serving as chief quality officer. I had responsibility for the health system's quality, patient safety, patient experience, as well as population health and analytics across the enterprise. And several months ago, I had really become very interested in that intersection of population health and analytics and was tapped on the shoulder by the folks here at Cardinal saying, hey, if this is something you really enjoy doing for the million people of Western North Carolina, why don't you come consider doing that for, the entire country at scale? And so that's how I got to join the company that I'm with today.
Got it. And for the listeners here, population health analytics is a two big words in healthcare today. Can you talk a little bit about Cardinal Analytics, kind of what you guys do, what solutions you offer to the healthcare market?
You bet. So Cardinal Analytics, not affiliated with the much, much larger, Cardinal Health. Our company was founded 4 years ago, spun out of Stanford by two Stanford professors, Dr. Arnie Milstein and Dr. Nigam Shah. And what they were really captivated by was when you look at populations of people and those who year over year change in both health acuity and their cost, there's a pretty significant change in what that population looks like every year. We're in about 60% of the folks in a current year's universe of very sick, high-cost patients are totally new to that population. And then it happens again the year after that. So they asked the question, is this a challenge that machine learning can help us solve? And the answer actually was yes. And so 4 years ago, they proved that out with some initial modeling and started this company. So 4 years later, we've ingested something like 21 million-ish lives within to our machine learning architecture, 7+ years of claims history. And what we found is we've been able to support this drive to population health. Our mission is better care sooner for providers, for health plans, for employers, really for anybody who has responsibility for a population of people and are equipped to try to move upstream of both health decline and rises in cost to intervene sooner. And that supports people to live healthier, better lives. It saves net cost overall and ultimately drives better outcomes for everyone.
And so it sounds like a really noble cause here. Being in a position where you were both a practicing physician and also now in a technology company, scaling that out across the entire healthcare ecosystem. I want to reference one quote you had where you credit President Roosevelt, where you said, real progress is won by people who take the next step, not those who theorize about the 200. I thought that was a great quote here. The fact that you kind of live both sides, would love to kind of understand how you view the macroeconomic issues tied to healthcare. Kind of what are the three biggest issues that you see out there? It doesn't have to be related to your specific industry, but across all.
Yeah, so you're exactly right. If you think about the challenges that we face in healthcare today, they are many and varied. So it can be incredibly challenging to dream of a world where you go from A to Q, and can seem exceptionally daunting to the point that, why would we even try? But I think the reality, Jeff, is that we live in a world today where we spend an unsustainable amount of our national resource on healthcare. In part, I think we do so because we solve for health care much more than we point towards health. And that, I think, is one big challenge that sort of then encompasses many, many others. And so because we solve for healthcare, we have a reimbursement model that is set up to serve healthcare and not necessarily people's health. We have entrenched interests across many silos throughout the industry who have been set up to operate in this way. And so I think one of the main challenges that we face nationally as we think through how do we evolve our healthcare system to better serve the health of Americans overall is moving upstream of healthcare and truly improving people's health. And in order to effectuate that change, there are a lot of next steps, to borrow from President Roosevelt, that need to happen kind of one after the other, and then an engine that needs to power it.
So the solving for healthcare instead of solving for health, do you have a prescription for that? Is there an anecdote or is there a secret sauce that could really shift the dialogue to solving for health?
Yeah, I think we're seeing two things beginning to align that are equipping folks to disrupt that paradigm. One is as reimbursement models move away from strict fee-for-service through this kind of value-based arrangement, nebulous universe, and into true sharing of risk with providers, that is now opening doors to thinking about caring for people outside of the four walls of healthcare. Simultaneously, we have this AI-enabled technology revolution that is layered on top of systems that most would not consider joy-enabling today. You know, it's been well documented by the AMA that doctors spend 2 hours face to screen for every hour that you spend face to face. I think that in large part is a problem of our own design, but one that as we bring the power of AI to the table, we can begin to reverse polarity on. And so if I had a prescription, I think that we live in a time that is uniquely positioned to begin bridging creative reimbursement models and technology that can support our ability to move upstream of healthcare by solving for health, predicting folks who are going to experience a health decline and a rise in cost before it happens, and now drive to outcomes that previously were both not possible from a technology perspective and not economically sustainable from a reimbursement perspective.
Got it. So the called the change in risk structures, reimbursement models, and AI. I call it those three, really playing together could solve a lot of the issues in terms of solving for health. I'll kind of highlight that, which is we've heard this a lot, which is disrupting healthcare. And you hear that a lot in the technology circles. How is disruption in healthcare possible or not? And if you think it is, I'd love to understand kind of when do you think we would have arrived where healthcare is disrupted?
So I think you're asking a very intriguing question, because I think the answer is yes. It is not only possible to disrupt healthcare, but we've been doing it iteratively for decades, and we will never actually arrive. You know, if you go back to 40s or even the 60s, the kinds of changes in reimbursement models that we saw with wage controls during World War II leading to employer-sponsored coverage, national coalitions around supporting healthcare for the elderly and for economically disadvantaged through Medicare and Medicaid. There have been very significant disruptions to the healthcare system in the entirety of its history. You look at the specialization of medicine, where my grandparents saw a physician who was a GP for everything from appendectomies to childbirth to home visits and so on. That is a world very, very different than we see today. And so I think the core challenge is really identifying what is the next disruption in healthcare. And I think what we're beginning to see, and you think about it a lot in the construct of your podcast, is a disruption that's centered around not only consumerism, but also the next generation of interventions that are now possible secondary to technological revolution. That, I think, is really what we're seeing as disruptive to kind of base case healthcare today, and what I'm really excited about in the future.
So I want to hold that thought on the technology revolution. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Payment Matters. I'm joined by Dr. Chris DiRienzo, Chief Medical Officer at Cardinal Analytics Solutions. So you highlighted technology, And technology is a powerful thing. It's amazing when you think that the iPhone was launched in 2007. So much has happened since then. How do you make a sense of technology tied to, I call it humanity, right? I think you've highlighted that in other writings here. There's I recall hearing Eric Schmidt talk from Google, who said that you can actually change the patient provider paradigm and just have the Google assistant be there in the room listening to everything, and great, you've made that experience better. Love to understand how you kind of view technology and actually how that works in that patient-provider relationship.
Yeah, so I had two comments on that. The first is, without advances in technology, my clinical field would be nowhere near as supportive for premiums as it is today. If you go back to 1963, the son of a president was born at 35 weeks gestation, and he died within his first week of life from a condition called Hyaline membrane disease. That was Patrick Bouvier Kennedy, August 1963. Today, he would have a well over 90% chance of survival, probably 99% chance of survival, and he would tower over, you know, as a giant, these tiny preemies who weigh 400 grams and 500 grams, because technology has enabled us to support these super preemie, you know, 17 weeks early, 18 weeks early, babies who just we would have had no capacity to do so in the past. So technology is not inherently evil. I don't believe that to be true. What I do believe to be true is that the way that we choose to implement technology and what we choose to point it at can either serve the human-to-human connection to healthcare, or it can draw from it. And in the HIT space specifically, I think that we've struggled as a community of really as a healthcare community in pointing technology at solutions that will drive more of the right kinds of human to human interactions. It's a field driven entry in medical records, you know, that were designed as billing systems or as documentation systems that basically just copied already inefficient paper workflows into an electronic manner, that is not necessarily designed to serve the human-to-human interaction. There are many, many cool things you can do with that data once it's in there, don't get me wrong. And there are laudable goals, I think, around which those were set up. However, I think that as we think through the next steps of our evolution as a tech-enabled healthcare ecosystem, we really have to focus on serving the people who are involved in providing healthcare to other people. And ways in which we can do that, I think specifically, live at that intersection of technology and humanity. AI is positioned to do that in part because it trains the same way that I trained as a doctor, right? As a doctor, I saw patient after patient after patient after patient, and I saw different constellations of signs and symptoms. I saw where outcomes led to, and so I had a, you know, labeled data set of the thousands of patients I saw as a resident and as a fellow, but I can only train my lenses on one patient at a time. AI, within a similarly labeled data set, can now train on millions of patients and then help point me to those who I most need to focus my human engagement with, you know, one-to-one, and maximally not only allow me to practice at the top of my license, but maximally ensure that I'm connecting with the patients who need me most. That, I think, is a tech-enabled solution that actually returns some humanity to our practice.
Got it. I kind of, as I'm listening and hearing the fact that AI is such a key driver in this, that really kind of, you know, I'll call it drives technology forward, but also makes the patient-provider interaction more fruitful and beneficial here. How, you know, and I also hear out there, which is there's so much data being out there, and AI is only as good as the data that's coming into that. I remember the operative word when I was doing technology consulting was business intelligence, and you can create a nice report or some dashboards or et cetera. But really, how do you make sure that the data or the intelligence coming out of the data is truly actionable? So, you know, I call it the 1% strategy and the 99% execution. How do you make sure that the data gets into the execution stage?
Yeah, I've definitely lived that firsthand. While I was still at Mission, we had this terrific, you know, kind of little skunk works data science team, very, very bright folks. And I remember asking them, you know, folks, we can predict readmissions way better than the score that we're using right now using machine learning. If we train it on years worth of our own data, we can build a model that's going to wipe the floor with LACE. and is totally gonna you know massively reduce our readmissions rate. And so we started, yeah, this is great. Built an incredible model. Andy Johnson and his team built that model, brought it to the care managers, and then it took us 9 months before we actually had it implemented in use with the right workflows, because I screwed up by not bringing care managers into the conversation from the absolute get-go. As you're pointing out, even a data science-driven model that works ridiculously better than anything else that you're doing today is still not necessarily better from a workflow perspective than what you're doing today. And humans have incredible capacity to create workarounds and then grow very attached to the way that I approach my work because there's inherent fear associated with a change to something else. So I think to answer your point, the way that we solve for not only providing a better mousetrap, but ensuring that it's used in a way that will catch more mice is by bringing the clinicians who are going to use any end state product into the room, beginning with design and talking through, here is what the future can look like. What kind of changes would this result in your staffing pattern? How will this change the way you think about your day? Does it change the skill mix of the folks who we need to be helping support this work? And by approaching it in that way, not only do you get to a better product at the end, but the stickiness, the outcomes that are achieved, I think vastly overwhelm any other approach that one could take.
Got it. Yeah, it sounds like you brought it back to the humanity. It's all about the people still. at the end of the day, you got to make sure that people are engaged and involved to drive that execution forward.
That's exactly right. And at least the clinicians who I speak with, and I get to ask this question all over the country now, what brings clinicians professional joy is the opportunity to engage one-to-one with their patients. Like I can feel like I'm really making a difference as a doctor when I'm in clinics face-to-face serving this person. And so the more that we can ensure that we're returning that time to folks at the bedside and then serving them with better information and serving them with the patients who most need their help, now we're really making a dent in what's largely been, I think, a tech-enabled solution world that has pulled humans away from bedsides.
As I'm kind of reminiscing on this, one of the things that we're hearing, and especially in your role in scaling some technology across the country, I don't even know if internationally is an ambition here, but scaling this technology, we also heard that healthcare is very local. The demographics and the people in different parts of the country are very different. I've also heard that in order to kind of create the best data models and be technical here, you got to have, you know, I think the three V's that we've heard, volume, velocity, and variety, and making sure you have that data to drive those great models. How do you address kind of as you're building these models and scaling out this technology across the country, that the model, the experience that you had in one place is scalable to all parts of the country?
Two answers to that. The first is I'm incredibly fortunate to partner with brilliant data scientists because in medical school, they definitely didn't teach us about how to build a machine learning model that is translatable across entities. What I've come to learn, though, is that's not an answer that I need to know how to get to. What I need to be able to do in a company like Cardinal Analytics is support these brilliant data scientists who know how to build exactly the model that you're describing and then make sure it's pointed at the right things. Right. So I've seen the magic of a partnership between clinicians who care about data science and data science who care about healthcare to leverage each other's strengths and be able to bring forward these data science driven advances connected to clinical action. And then to your latter point, every local healthcare market is different. Every health system is different. There are, of course, some commonalities in the way that folks think about peer provider relations and the way that folks think about primary care and the way that care management teams are set up. They're not totally unique, but once you get past kind of those very initial commonalities, what's really deeply required is an integration partnership with folks on the ground. And so I think no matter how translatable the model is, being able to then serve the folks who you're handing off these predictions to with the ability to then act on them is the kind of the crucial lever to driving scale.
Got it. Talking about scale here, especially with technology and looking at data and AI, we're starting to see, I call it atypical entrance into the healthcare IT market. The Apples, the Googles, the Amazons, the Microsofts, the large tech titans, thinking about getting them into getting into healthcare and solving major problems. What's your opinion or impression about how, you know, how successful these tech titans will be in addressing some of the critical issues tied to solving for health?
Yeah, I think that healthcare, like any industry, is not monolithic. You know, so when I think about trying to compare an Uber-like or an Amazon experience to quote broad healthcare, you know, I think that that's like comparing an Apple to, I don't know, a Fiat, right? I think there are aspects of our experience as consumers of healthcare that very naturally lend themselves to the kinds of innovations that, you know, the Ubers and Lyfts and Amazons have brought to the market, which largely match areas of capacity that have not been most efficiently utilized in the past with the consumer-driven demand for that capacity. So, I think about folks who in the acute care world are leveraging telemedicine right now so that providers who previously were waiting for folks to physically engage with them in a space are now much more efficiently utilizing their time engaging with patients, you know, via a telemedicine interface on an app that is both better for the provider from an efficiency perspective and is a better experience oftentimes for the patient because they can be sitting on their couch and then get some guidance that's needed either to drive them to utilization they really need or keep them from an inefficient use of healthcare resource that really was not needed. What I'm really intrigued to see as we see new entrants into the health market is where these innovators in other industries have made substantial gains, how they'll be thinking about pointing that not just to healthcare, but to health.
Got it. It's a tough problem to solve, and it's always great to have other entrants in this market here. And also, typically we talk about payment a lot. We talked about reimbursement models here, but more and more of the consumers out there are bearing the burden of healthcare. It's increasing in costs for out of pocket. How does that impact the clinical aspect of the providers or even your company? Kind of how do you see that impacting them as consumers are now financially more liable for their healthcare?
Yeah, I think as a nation, it's something we have to be really cautious about because the more we expose people to cost in healthcare, the more challenging we may find ourselves when folks are making decisions that are inelastic. And I guess what I mean by that is some of the most elastic price decisions that we make have to do with things like preventative care. So, oh, I'm not going to go get my flu shot, that's too expensive. Or, no, I'm not going to get my screening colonoscopy, that's too expensive. And so if we expose consumers to burden of price on these preventative services that we know at a societal level, spending dollars on reduces total cost of care over a lifetime, then I think we're doing a disservice. You know, where I think there is great opportunity for a deeper conversation in kind of a market-based consumerism universe is around sort of these preference-sensitive conditions. There have been reports in the literature on price spreads of, you know, 5x on procedures that would be considered elective procedures within even one local marketplace. And I think as consumers who are choosing down an elective pathway to undergo procedure X, or employers are deciding who they're going to partner with for, you know, particular bundles, that's where I think there's opportunity for this kind of market-based competition. We just need to be really, really careful that we don't do the opposite of what we're intending, which is expose consumers to price on those things for which they're fairly elastic, and then wind up also exposing them to price on decisions that they really have no choice over.
Which would impact their health, right, at the end of the day. Yeah.
That's right. You know, I think about, you know, reports of people who are in, you know, massive motor vehicle accidents and are airlifted to a trauma center. And that is not the time to expose a consumer to a price-based decision because they are unconscious and they're in the back of a helicopter. They don't get to make a decision about that. Similarly, being able to have your screening colonoscopy, which is going to catch your colon cancer at stage one before you wind up on, you know, stage four with massively expensive procedure and chemotherapy, that is not the time, I don't think personally, to expose consumers to price on healthcare. But I think in this middle space, you know, the healthcare is not monolithic. There's a middle space market where I think a lot of cost effectiveness decisions would make a lot of sense, that today I don't think we've really created a system that offers that opportunity.
This has been a highly interesting talk for me. Last question here, which is, what's your vision for healthcare in 10 years from now? What would you like to see, and what do you think is going to be different in 10 years?
Yeah, I've been thinking on this one for 24 hours, trying to get ready for this show, Jeff. And, you know, I was on the train in to work this morning, and it's about a 30-minute ride, and I couldn't help but notice out the window all of these places and entities that serve health that today we really do not think of as health care. I think about how health is impacted within communities, and I saw some with sidewalks, some without, some healthy communities, some unhealthy communities. I think about schools. I passed pharmacies and grocery stores and restaurants and parks. And I think in an ideal state, 10 years from now, we're thinking much more holistically as a nation about health and how we're improving people's health. And healthcare is one part of that, but there's an enormous amount of data that says that what we can do for you in the healthcare system impacts a vastly lower percentage of your likelihood of being healthy than all of these other aspects of your life. And if you put up our GDP spend on healthcare relative to other developed nations across the world, it's way higher. But then when you put up our spend on every other kind of social support network that helps drive health, things like education and transportation and so on, now all of a sudden everybody catches up to us. And so I think we've made this decision as a country to invest a ton of resource in healthcare, and only now are just beginning to think through how we can begin matching that resource with spends that really in other areas of people's lives can support healthier being. And so in 10 years, my hope is that we've made the conscious decision as a country to begin focusing our healthcare resource not just on how do I care for you once you have, you know, morbid obesity or stage 4 cancer or you've smoked for 50 years or, you know, et cetera. We'll always need very high quality acute care services for high acuity needs. But I dream of a world in this country where a vastly significant amount of resource is now focused on driving health.
That's it's a bold statement, and I look forward to that happening in 10 years. So this has been a great podcast. Love this perspective that you provided to us today. For people that want to learn more about you or your company, how can they find out more?
Yeah, so the Cardinal Analytics, our website walks through how we think about this challenge. You know, in order to power a drive to health, we have to be able to kind of look around the corner and understand what tomorrow's risk looks like. And so if folks go online to our website, cardinalanalytics.com, they can see where our offerings can help plans, providers, employers kind of partner in that space. You can learn more about me there as well. You can reach out on LinkedIn. My website is drdirienzo.com. And I've got a book coming out this summer called Tiny Medicine, and you can find links to it there too.
Chris, thank you so much again for being on the show. And to all the listeners out there, thank you to all of you for listening in today. Remember that you can listen into this episode weekdays at 4:30 a.m., 12:30 p.m., and 8:30 p.m. Eastern. You can also listen to this on Apple Podcasts, Google Play Music, or just say, Alexa, play Healthcare Now Radio. If you have a comment about the episode of the show, follow hashtag Payment Matters or connect with me on Twitter at Jeff B. Lynn. You can learn more about the show at healthcarenowradio.com or at instamed.com. Until next time, I'm Jeff Lynn.